Hello, and welcome to the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by CoinBits. We bring Bitcoin news, hot topics of conversation, and deep dives into a variety of Bitcoin topics to you weekly. We are CoinBits, a Bitcoin financial services company. Check us out at coinbits.app. This recording is for informational purposes only. No investment or legal or any other advice should be drawn from this content. And as always, consult an advisor before making any legal or financial decisions.
Hello there, David. Hey, Kate, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah,
got
happy
a couple
to be
people
here.
Rolling in here.
Yeah,
thank you. So I'm just standing. I'm outside the Miami Beach Convention Center. I just like popped out. It's been like super hot and humid, and it was just kind of like I wanted a little privacy to talk, and it's been nice out. So I stepped outside, and of course it's drizzling.
Oh,
and there's like
God.
No overhang, so it's all good. But I am standing here in a little bit of a drizzle, and but the conference has been interesting. I just saw Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speak. We can talk about that a little later. He talked about the Canadian truckers, actually.
That
yeah.
Was interesting.
It was, yeah. Michael Saylor was there. Anyway, it was cool. Yeah, it's going well. How are you?
I'm good, actually. This is my first space. So I've always just been kind of lurking in here and was always kind of afraid that people would be able to hear me. And then I realized that if my microphone is not on, then I would be okay. So yeah, it's an interesting experience to be just looking at my phone and saying, this is a broadcast. Cool. Technology.
Yeah. It's actually a great platform.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's a couple minutes past the hour. I guess I'm just going to kick us off. We do record these, so I'm going to do a little bit of an intro for posterity. So when we release this as a podcast, we'll have that. We are CoinBits. Welcome to our space. We do this every week. We talk about a personality or thought leader, an influencer, a technology developer, somebody who is contributing to Bitcoin. And today we have Kate Wand, and we do have a special announcement about Kate Wand that we'll talk about a little bit later. But Kate is a thought leader and content creator in the Liberty space. I'll let her get into that a little bit later. A little bit about CoinBits. So CoinBits is a Bitcoin-only financial services company. We are based in the United States, and we help you acquire Bitcoin, small amounts of Bitcoin, large amounts. We help you get started. If you don't kind of know where to start, you can start with us. We have a very simple platform that we've designed to be easy to use. We also have retirement accounts. We have some business products that we're going to be releasing soon. So if you're a business and you're interested in either offering Bitcoin retirement benefits to your employees or holding a Bitcoin treasury on your balance sheet, or you have any other ideas for interesting applications of Bitcoin in your business, do get in touch with us. We can help you think through all of that. And I do have to say that anything you hear in this session is not financial advice. We can't tell you that you should buy Bitcoin. We can talk about how great Bitcoin is and how we think that it is a monetary revolution. But you need to make your own decisions about whether to buy it. And that could have to do with your goals that are specific to you. So you should talk to a licensed financial planner, not us, to make that decision. And with that, I'm going to hand it over for a more detailed introduction to David, who is also with us on CoinBits. David, why don't you just give us a little intro to Kate and kick us off?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Dave. So I'd love to just announce to everybody here, and Dave, if you want to add a link or kind of nest tweet this, we're really excited to announce that Kate is the latest ambassador in our ambassador program at CoinBits. And you know, she's joining Alex Crignali, a professional soccer player, the Meme Factory, and just really a great team of ambassadors that we're building here. And with that, you know, we're going to talk with Kate today about her work, Bitcoin, and, you know, just do a really deep dive into all of the, you know, talking about the concepts that drive the really great content that she's created for the past few years. So Kate, I'd love it if you kind of just gave a background of, you know, your, like, kind of how you got into making the content that you do, and, you know, kind of just a general overview of, you know, maybe include how you discovered Bitcoin, how you basically got into making kind of liberty focused content.
Yeah, Dave, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And yeah, I'm very, very excited to be an ambassador for Coinbits. This is really, I think, a great company and a neat thing to be a part of. I think that there's so much I could say about how I got started in all of this. It's really kind of the story of my life in a way. I've always been into a couple of things since I was very little. And so that has been music, philosophy, art, literature, and truth seeking, I would say. That's been one kind of important thing that has kept me going throughout my life. I was always kind of an out of the box thinker and a little bit of a black sheep. And kind of introverted. And so I always like to think about the world and, you know, what my place was in the world and just kind of how everything all fit in and what do you do with a life? You know, I remember thinking from the time I was very little, like, what am I going to want to do with my life? And that was just a question that, you know, kind of kept me on my toes and kept me pursuing different things. And so if I kind of fast forward to 2020 and paint a picture for everybody of what my life looked like then, it was December 2019, actually, a little bit before that. I was with my partner, William. He at that time was a captain for a major airline. And I was teaching private music lessons. And so we were living in the city and we thought, you know what, we got to get out of here. Like, we want to have a shire. So we want to be able to be somewhere where we can actually kind of live on the land, you know, have a garden, maybe have some animals. We did end up later getting pigs, which is another story that was ended in comedy and tragedy all at once. And so that was kind of our where we were going. We just wanted to have more of a life that was kind of connected to nature, but not in the hippie sense. Like, we just wanted to have space. We wanted to be self-sufficient and we wanted to raise a family. And so we started hunting. And so we basically drew a map around the airport and where he was based and said, okay, an hour and 45 minute radius, like, let's look for a property within that in any direction. And so we finally ended up finding this amazing shire. And as soon as we were driving down the driveway, which was a mile long, we were like, okay, this is it. And so we bought this beautiful property. It was 42 acres of forest, and it was just incredible. We managed to get a tractor in the deal. We started like digging up some earth and making this huge garden and doing all of this kind of stuff. And so, you know, life was really great. And we said, okay, it's time for us to start a family soon now that we're installed here. And then March 2020, of course, life changed for everybody. And so when that happened, we immediately thought that this was going to be a massive power grab. We never thought that COVID was about a virus. You know, maybe people have opinion on, you know, the actual facts around COVID, but we just understood that if they're willing to kind of stop the whole machine of the economy globally, this, you know, is for a bigger reason than just some respiratory virus, right? And so we understood that. And if I go a little bit backwards, you know, we had really been into philosophy and history and kind of like getting red-pilled together. We were reading a lot about libertarianism, classical liberalism, reading about the old kind of thinkers and schools of thought around there, Ayn Rand, Hayek, Mises, Bastiat. And so we were already on that journey. And so we kind of understood that, you know, this would be where things were going. Anyways, so once that happened, we just said, well, we're kind of screwed because we've put all of our eggs in one basket. And we now have this mortgage, this brand new mortgage, and I don't know how we're going to pay it. And so we just kind of plucked at every single resource available to us at that time. And that included Bitcoin. And that was where we actually kind of got involved in Bitcoin, was we said, I think that, you know, there's something interesting going on here. And I think that we were reading about Bitcoin before 2020. And so we said, maybe it's time for us to just buy some Bitcoin, even though we don't have a lot of money at all. Like we're running out here. We're like a sinking ship. But let's see if we can just put some money in there, because we saw that there was like this implosion of the monetary system that was probably taking place, and like who knew how long that would take. But you know, we didn't really understand all of the details of it, but we understood that something was going on there. And so that dipping our toes into Bitcoin at that point actually allowed us to make some mortgage payments, believe it or not. It allowed us to keep our property for just long enough that we could stay there until our son was born. I was pregnant actually in the summer of 2020. And so we were able to kind of hang on to our house. And by the time it was our son's first birthday, we were selling the house. And then we said, okay, whatever we do moving forward, we're going to have to change our mentality about finances and, you know, about what it means to own a home and what you look for there. So that kind of ties into the whole financial freedom aspect of my philosophy and my husband's, which I'll get into later. While all of this was going down, I was pregnant, we were broke, we were scrambling. There was also a lot going on in the world that we felt people, you know, some people were talking about, but not everybody was talking about. And so at that point, me being this musician who was, you know, I had a microphone, I had some equipment, I was already recording some music videos for my students. And my husband is an audiophile. He had studied cinema when he was in college before his flying days. And we just said, let's put up some videos on YouTube. And the first series was kind of really niche for us, and it was about the aviation industry and what was going on there in Canada, because many countries in the world were bailing out their aviation industries with all of the lockdowns and all of the effects of closing those operations. But Canada wasn't doing it. And so very early on, we were aware of this weird thing called the Great Reset. And I had gone on the Great Reset website and seen that they had pictures of planes breaking in half, you know, in order to save the planet and that whole kind of thing. And so this just kind of confirmed that this was a big power grab and a way to kind of forcibly shift the world into a new era. And so I just, you know, recorded my thoughts, put it out on YouTube, and from there kind of gained some traction. And then we continued to do some videos, and within two or three videos, we were recruited at that time by Jeffrey Tucker, who had been at AIER as the editorial director. And he said, "Wow, I really love your videos. Do you want to come do some for us as well?" And we were like, "Yeah, absolutely." And so that kind of just gave us this other, you know, this new drive, because now this was a gig and now we had another kind of direction to go in. And that has been really beneficial, because we've got to learn from some of the best economic thinkers and, you know, liberty people. And we got really connected with people in the liberty movement. We started working as well with Pandata, Nick Hudson and Abir Balan. We started working with Bruce Party. We've now done some videos for the Ideas Institute, which is a new think tank in Canada. And so we just kind of built up our portfolio from there. And then, of course, I continue just publishing videos on my YouTube channel, which are just, basically my own twist on things. So that's the long story short.
Wow. That was wonderful. That's definitely the best background that anybody's ever given on our Coinbits Twitter spaces. That was really great.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. I guess, so Kate, you've been putting together some really good videos recently. And I wanted to talk with you about your second latest video. You talked about Isaiah's job, like the remnant mm-hmm. concept. And I wanted to get into that with you. Like, you know, how'd you come across that essay? Because it's interesting. It's like, it's a very old essay, but, you know, Alexander Tversky was writing articles about it in Bitcoin Magazine, I think in like 2021. It feels like there's been a real resurgence of interest in that essay and, you know, that concept of the remnant, and would love to just talk with you about that and like how that informs how we should live today.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, there's a lot in there, but I came across that essay actually because I was listening to a Canadian Bitcoin podcast. I forget the name of it. My apologies. But they had interviewed Francis Pouliot, who is founder of Bull Bitcoin, which is based out of, I believe they're based out of Alberta. But Francis is from Montreal, like me. And so he had talked about that essay on the podcast, right? So as you're saying, it's like, you know, the Bitcoin world is kind of involved in that idea of the remnant. And so I read the essay and I was like, yes, this is exactly it. This is kind of, you know, exactly where I'm at, where, you know, my family's at. And so I decided to do a video about it. And so the idea of the remnant, you know, and Isaiah's job. So Isaiah was a prophet, and you know, during his time, he was going around, you know, on the directive of from God to preach to people and tell them, you know, what a terrible lot they were, and that if they didn't change their ways, that things were going to go to hell in a handbasket. And so he told Isaiah, go out and preach now. But he also said, but it won't do any good. I just want to let you know. And so Isaiah pondered this and said, you know, well, what is the point in, you know, if the enterprise were to be a failure from the start, why was there any sense in starting it at all? And then God said, well, there's something that you don't understand, Isaiah, is that there's a remnant that you know nothing about. And he was referring to how there were all kinds of people who were disorganized, who were disconnected, who didn't necessarily know each other in real life, but that they understood the world in a different way than the masses. And that they were the ones who would kind of go out there and go about living their lives in a way that I guess was more aligned with purpose and values that were very unique to this kind of remnant. And the remnant didn't necessarily know the other remnant existed. So I guess the binding principles were that the remnant were leading lives of purpose and meaning and kind of focused on liberty, really, on freedom of the mind, which was a feature that the masses didn't really partake in. And so this is very similar to what I see today. And so basically the idea was, as God told Isaiah, your job is to keep the remnant going. So when you're preaching, who you're really preaching to is them, because your words will inspire them to keep going, even though they don't feel like they have any allies, even though they think that things are getting really dark, and they are. You keep them going, you know, and keep them hanging on. And then once the masses have brought everything down to destruction and they've basically brought the world to its knees, well, then the remnant are going to be there to pick up the pieces. And so they're going to be the ones who the masses will eventually turn to look to show them like how to rebuild the world from the thing that they destroyed. So, I mean, I thought that this was such an interesting concept. And, you know, I'm also reading this other book, which is really interesting, called The Revolt of the Public by Martin Burry. I'll get into it maybe a little bit later. But one of the things that Burry talks about in this book is a distinction between the crowd and the masses. So the crowd, which Burry talks about, is kind of like the remnant. It's people who actually have something in common, whereas the masses, they have something in common too, but what they have in common is something that's been put into their heads from the authority, from top down. Whereas a crowd kind of rises spontaneously. It's like an organic thing, and it's some kind of principle that unites them. A perfect example of this in real life would be the truckers convoy in Canada. So that, you know, that was not the masses who came out to show their support for liberty and their distaste for the ongoing COVID restrictions. It was really the remnant who came out of their house, you know, and just actually showed up somewhere. And then they became the crowd who led this movement. But it was, Trudeau referred to it as a small fringe minority. And in a sense, it was a minority. You know, it was not like the whole country who came to support that. And in fact, the Canadian propaganda media ended up being able to spin it so that the truckers were really bad, hateful, white supremacist, ultra white ring, right wing, whatever you want to call it. So what I think about this is that it's a really important thing to think about moving forward, is that, you know, like a lot of people are still living in this fantasy world where change happens because mass opinion is swayed. And I don't think that that's true. I think that some things are going to play out until people can actually see the result of those things. And then once they see how badly they have fucked up, excuse my language, I don't know if I can swear on here, but once they actually see the destruction that has been brought about by themselves, then they have no choice but to kind of look at it and to come to terms with it in some kind of way. And then there's kind of hope for things to rebuild again. And it's kind of like that meme where, you know, good times create strong, what is it? It's strong men create good times create weak men create hard times, and then the whole thing comes around again. So we're kind of at that point where now we're in the hard times. And the hard times are creating strong men, and that's kind of in the remnant. And those people will kind of rise when the time is right. But I don't think we're at that tipping point yet. And I don't mean to be pessimistic. I just simply think that's the way it is.
Yeah, I love the way that you put that. And, you know, I don't think we're at that tipping point yet, but it certainly feels like we're getting closer. I saw Charles Murray, he's kind of mainstreamish, intellectual. He was tweeting that like a week ago that it feels like we're like our the elites that govern us today are like characters from Atlas Shrugged. And yeah. And I was like, yeah, that's true. They're totally unserious people. And then exactly like you described, there's like the crowd and then there's the masses. And I don't want to like seem like I'm talking down to people, because, you know, for a lot of people, there's no incentive to really break from the masses. At least they don't think they're the right incentives there. But in reality, a lot of the people in the a group that you would call the masses are really like, it's just NPCs. Like, it's just, it's, mm-hmm. it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. So I loved the way that you put all of that. And that brings me to the next thing that I wanted to talk about. And that was really like, you know, 2020, because I think 2020 woke a lot of people up. Like, I think that you had the government response to COVID. Then at the same time, you had all of this monetary stuff going on. And it was just like a really big power grab on behalf of governments. Mm-hmm. And it's still going on. But in your the video that you put out, the one of them, you talked about kind of like moving on from that like 2020 mindset and still focus. Like, I think that, and I wanted to kind of explore that because I really liked the way you put it, but it's not intuitive. Like, it's because a lot of people are like, we still have to like discover whether COVID came from a lab or not. Right. Or it's like, you know, I think that the government has already moved on. Like, they're already fighting like new battles. So yeah, I would just love to kind of explore that.
Yeah, they've declared the emergency is over now, right? But but yeah, so basically, you know, what I think is that there hasn't been a reckoning, right? Like, there hasn't been this admission of fault or any, you know, and that's from politicians and from the masses as well. And yeah, like I talk about the masses in the kind of derogatory sense, but yes, of course, it's made up of regular people. I think, you know, largely those are people who don't necessarily pursue a meaning in their life. You know, maybe they do at some points, but for whatever reason, they're susceptible to a kind of mass propaganda is because they're waiting for something else to kind of fill the void that's external. But anyways, so what I think about the whole 2020 thing is that people who have been in the resistance, so, you know, people who were anti-lockdown, anti-mask, anti-vax, all of those pejorative terms, but let's just take them and use them in the true sense of the word, is people who were pro-liberty. A lot of them now, I think, are having a hard time coming to terms with the fact that there's not going to be this admission of regret or of, you know, taking responsibility or of saying, you know, we made a big mistake and we're going to apologize. We're going to pay the consequences. We're going to, you know, like, authoritarians can't do that. They can't say, hey, we made a huge mistake, because that would delegitimize their power even more in a world where their power is already so pushed back on just by the sheer amount of information and decentralization in the world. You know, like, anything that a politician does, or like Neil Ferguson having an affair, you know, during lockdowns and breaking the lockdown orders, like, we find out about all of these things. And the more that that people, like ordinary people, you know, remnants, are able to share this kind of information online, the more that their power is threatened. So of course they're never going to admit to error, right? So it's kind of like when you, like, let's say you imagine that you have some grievances with your parents, you know, from your childhood. Like, you grew up into an adult and you were like, you know what, it really affected me when blah, blah, blah. Like, my parents would do this or this or that, you know? And then you go to your parents and you say, hey, look, you know, I just want to let you know that it really hurt me as a child when you did this or this or that. Like, most parents, I would say, like, most of them, you know, if they're psychologically aware, maybe, but most people, you know, are just going to be like, oh, I just want to sweep this under the rug. Like, I don't want to talk about this. I, you know, I don't want to face any of this. So then does that mean that you can't move on as a human being? Like, does that mean that you can't have psychological freedom? Does that mean that you're going to spend the rest of your life blaming your parents for the way that your life turned out shittier than it could have been if you had had a healthier childhood? It's the same kind of thing with people who are stuck in 2020. Like, they expect that the people who caused them harm are going to save them now by lending them some kind of olive branch or apology or whatever it is. Like, it's just simply not going to happen. And the more that they hold on to that, or the more that they hold on to the mainstream media, like covering, you know, information that they knew was true in 2020, you know, they're looking for something external to allow them to live their lives again. And, you know, that is giving all of your power away to somebody else. Like, you're not a free person if you do that. You don't have psychological freedom if you think that the world owes you explanations. Like, everything that you need to do to lead your own life comes from you and comes from, you know, whether you are spiritual or whether you believe in a higher power or whatever it is, it all kind of comes down to the same thing. Your life and the purpose of your life is something that only you can discover for yourself. And you have to be able to do it in spite of all of the external pressures and even the internal pressures, like the psychological mechanisms that might have been conditioned in you from the way that you grew up. Like, you have to develop your psychological freedom by like actively seeing all of those things and how you kind of feel about them and react to them, and then coming to terms with them, and then not depending on anyone else to solve the problem for you. So, you know, I think that, like, there's also a lot of grief for people from what happened in 2020, and they're unable to let go of that because they're not processing the grief. Like, they're still kind of stuck in a fight or flight mode, or they're still angry, or they still feel depressed, or they feel like helpless. So they've got all of these like triggers that have been ignited in them at a very kind of like personal level, and they're looking for something outside of themselves to resolve that, rather than saying, okay, I have to grieve what I lost. You know, like, I have to grieve the fact that, you know, in my example, that we had to sell that house, that we lived in this tiny shithole apartment while we figured out what to do next, that my husband lost his career of 18 years as a pilot, you know, that my grandparents were pretty much killed by the state because of all of the things that they did in the long-term care homes. Like, there was a lot of grief there, you know, so you have to kind of go through all of those things to truly let them go. And then you can say, okay, now I've processed that. Now what am I going to do? Now what am I going to do with my life? Because if you want to stay in that victim mindset, it can seem easier because you don't actually have to focus on what you're going to do to move forward. You can actually just stay in this static place where you don't really have to do anything except for bitch about things. And that is a recipe for disaster.
Hey, Kate. My kids are graduating college in about 2033. If we're still friends, can you give their commencement speech?
Oh my gosh. yeah, sure. I would love to.
No, I just thought, like not towards the middle there, it was like very commencement like. It was like, you know, you can do this. You can take control and like actualize and be who you were meant to be. I thought that was fantastic. Yes. I think you know, I totally agree with you that people looking for quote unquote accountability from the people that perpetrated the crime is totally backwards. But the thing is that they're so used to it. In fact, even our political class, they're constantly talking about this word accountability. It's actually starting to grate on me anytime somebody says, hold them accountable, you know, in this ridiculous political like accent that everybody speaks in. It's always like, hold them accountable. We got to hold these people accountable. We got to hold those people accountable. It's like this phrase that means nothing, because the people who have done it, who've perpetrated the crime, are using that phrase. And so then you're like, okay, so you need to shift your perspective. There's not a common ground here. They're not on your side. They're your opponent. Mm-hmm. You know, you accept that you now have to accept that they're your opponent. I actually think this is one of the things that I run into when I'm orange pilling people about Bitcoin. It's like framing the other side as the opponent, and then drawing upon what power you do have, the instrumentalities of power that you do have, to go to into a competition with them. We don't have to call it battle. We don't have to call them enemies if we're not comfortable with that. They're your opponent, though. They oppose yeah. what you want. And then you need to draw upon the tools that you have in this game, in this conflict, to try to win the conflict. And then so that's why Bitcoin is so powerful, because it is leverage. It is something that they don't control. And a lot of the power that they have to wield in this conflict comes from the fact that they have a money printer of fiat. And so Bitcoin is a way of doing two things. It empowers you within the communities of people that you, within the remnant, right? It allows yeah. you to trade within the remnant and build those trust networks and those networks of commerce. And then it also removes capital from your other side's dominion, like the other side's ability to influence. I don't know what you think about that. Is that a good way of thinking how Bitcoin plays a role, or how would you when you're speaking to people about these issues, how do you frame the value of Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, that's a really, really good point, Dave. And I guess, you know, for me, how I see Bitcoin, I agree with what you just said. I hadn't really framed it that way, and I hadn't necessarily thought of it that way directly, but indirectly, yes. And I think that it's that, as you said, the fiat system is the opponent to Bitcoin in a certain sense. And I mean, maybe there will be a world where both systems will exist. I don't know what the outcomes are going to be, but in the fiat system, everything is controlled in a top-down manner. Everything is centralized. Everything is arbitrary, so it can be changed at a moment's notice. It can be changed to suit the whims of the powers that be and their needs and the people at the top of the hierarchies. And, you know, if that fiat system, you know, it went from a fiat system that was related to coins and to gold, and then moved into, you know, just paper, which was a lot easier to just print. And now it's become digital paper that you can just add to the balance sheet when you want to put more money in or out. And then now they want to extend that even more into CBDCs, you know, and so CBDCs would be an instrument that they would be able to use to change, you know, money at a whim, to basically say, okay, now, you know, we're inflating it directly in your bank account, or we're expiring the date that you can spend this money, or whatever it is. Like, they can kind of program the money to be, you know, whatever they want. Or they could say, oh, well, you know, in this green new world, you can only spend so much money on gas per month, or whatever it is. So, like, it's a system of complete control. And that's not even talking about the surveillance element, which is that they would be able to see everything that you do. And if you think about that, like, how important privacy is in your exchanges of money with people. I mean, that's your footprint. Wherever you go, whatever you do, like, you're trading all the time, right? And so even if that's just, you know, if you want to just give $10 to a friend to, like, go run into the store and grab something for you, like, it doesn't matter. Like, every single thing that you do, like, it builds a pattern about your life that would be in the hands of, like, very, very far away authorities, so, like, really not close to you at all. And, like, how would those people have your best interests at heart? And then on the other hand, you have Bitcoin, which is a money that was created, you know, by a bunch of nerds, essentially. And we don't really know who it was, but there are some ideas about who Satoshi Nakamoto was and the influences there. The philosophical influences of Bitcoin largely stem from Austrian economics and from, you know, principles of freedom, including Ayn Rand's Galt's Gulch. So basically, like, communities, like a digital community for people to be able to exchange in a way that's unfettered by the monopolistic system, right? So it breaks up the monopoly that exists. And That's extremely empowering on its own. And the fact that they haven't been able to tinker with it or to shut it down or to manipulate it, like, it just shows its strength, right? And so there's so much trust, just because of how long it's gone on in a certain sense. And I mean, I know a great deal about Bitcoin. I don't know everything. I'm really excited to kind of go down a rabbit hole and explore a lot more among Bitcoiners and see kind of what are the ins and outs of Bitcoins that I don't know about yet. And I'm excited to learn. But I think that it's a tool for financial freedom because it's a sound money, right? And it's a private money. And I just saw this the other day from Michael Saylor. He said, it's a truthful money. And, you know, I think in a way what he meant by that were probably some things that I don't yet understand, but what that meant to me, a truthful money, is that it is money that can't be manipulated in the ways that I described for fiat or CBDC. Like, it's a money that you can actually trust. You know, if you have Bitcoin, if you HODL Bitcoin, or if you trade Bitcoin or whatever it is, like, you know that there is no central authority who's doing anything to it, and they can't do anything to it. And so they could never use it as an instrument. It's kind of like in Lord of the Rings, that one ring to rule them all. Like, that's the ring of monopoly, and of complete centralized authority. But Bitcoin is the opposite of that. There is no ring. Bitcoin is like the Shire in a sense, and it doesn't belong to any one institution or any one person. Like, it literally exists for the people, and it was created for those purposes. It was created, you know, for the public, and it's used by the public. And the more that it gets used by the public, kind of against what's to come in the future. And so, like, that's something that's really important for me. Like, you know, we HODL Bitcoin. Like I said, we use that to help us out, you know, very early on when we needed to. But, like, we see it as a way to have savings for our future as well, for our son's future. Like, you know, I don't know what the world is going to look like by the time that he's an adult. He's 2 years old now, but that, like, gives us some security. And, you know, to some people who say, well, you know, what if governments eventually make the on-ramps and the off-ramps illegal and things like that? Like, there are many things that they can try to do to disrupt people's ability to use it. But, you know, my answer to that is, like, if things get that bad, you know, like, then the authoritarians are really showing their hand. Like, you have other problems to think about too. You know, like, maybe that are even worse. So, I don't know all of the answers, but I hope that that kind of explains, you know, how I see it a little bit for you
That's
guys.
great. We do have a question from someone in the audience. Ouroboros Tail, which is a cool name, asked in the chat, "Hi folks, my confusion about crypto surrounds its variability of value. Many people make money, quote unquote, with crypto, apparently due to the change of value compared to money and goods. This suggests if we gain wealth from crypto, it is a simultaneous loss for others." And so that's a good question. Let me start answering it just to kind of set the stage, and then I'll hand it over to Kate and David if you guys want. But so the first thing there is the question is about crypto generally. And so crypto is usually refers to coins, tokens, things that are not Bitcoin. Bitcoin is technically a cryptocurrency. But over the last few years, since 2020, certainly, it's become really clear that the word crypto has like morphed into this thing that means everything besides Bitcoin. So Bitcoin and crypto, they're two different categories. Crypto is usually like a share in a project or a company. It's like a stock. So when you buy crypto, you're placing a bet that this project or this team that's building something is going to do something of value. And so one day that crypto being kind of a share in that project or that company is going to be worth more, and then you're going to sell it. So it's not to say that crypto has like no use case, but it's just a totally different thing. Bitcoin is a protocol. It's just a computer code that's open source that anybody can run. There's no issuer of Bitcoins. there's no single issuer. It's a commodity. So it's more like a digital commodity that's totally neutral and has no management team, no marketing team. There's nobody like paid to tell you to buy it in the same way as crypto. It's just this thing that's out there on the internet. And something that, you know, I don't love this metaphor. It's not perfect, but some people it's helpful for, like, crypto or like AOL or like other like services that you can buy, whereas Bitcoin is more like the internet, the web. It's just a set of protocols that any computer can use to interact with other computers and exchange value. So that's the first thing there. The second thing is about valuation. It's a great question. And the reason that Bitcoin fluctuates in value is because people have different amounts of information that they have, and they don't understand necessarily what Bitcoin is. They think about it as a stock or as an investment. They want to buy in, not because they want to hold it forever and because they think that the economy will transition to a Bitcoin standard, but instead because they want to sell it later and make money. And so all the people doing that who don't really understand Bitcoin and have good information about it, they're going to sell, they're going to come in and out of the market all the time. This causes a tremendous swing in the price. However, if you look at Bitcoin over a five-year period, it appreciates in dollar terms over 5 years. So over a long term, that would be why somebody like me, I would hold Bitcoin for the long term, because I want to opt out of the fiat system, but I'm not impatient about it. I'm going to like build over time. And eventually, because for me, it's kind of a hedge against, you know, the failure of these unethical monies, these corrupt people who did cover up the crimes of 2020, and who will never admit their mistake or their aggression against us. And so this is a way of opting out completely. You would expect that the exchange rate for Bitcoin and the things you can buy with it, products and services and so on, would start to stabilize eventually as adoption increases, because as you have more users, you know, there's a price discovery process that occurs. And then, you know, as things start to be priced in Bitcoin and people start using it on a day-to-day basis instead of just using it to get rich trading, you would imagine that you would expect that it would level out. And in fact, that has happened historically with new forms of money as they have monetized, as other objects have transitioned from becoming like mundane objects to money, forms of money. You've kind of seen the same volatility during that whole process. So that's kind of a brief answer, but Kate, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, for sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'm just opening up the tab here to see the question. Thanks, Ouroboros Tail. So to your last point, you know, this suggests if we gain wealth from crypto, it is a simultaneous loss for others. And I would agree with everything that you said there, Dave, as well about Bitcoin being different from crypto, for sure. Bitcoin is very unique. So I don't see it as like gaining wealth from Bitcoin at the expense of anybody else. It just simply doesn't work that way, I don't think. It's not like this pie that's being divided amongst people, and so like if you have a bigger piece, somebody else has a smaller piece. It's basically a new type of currency, and it's a type of currency that has been built upon principles and not upon a power hierarchy or like some kind of, you know, structure that favors people in power compared to the little guys. So like it's a very different system. So I think it requires you to kind of think about money in a different way. Like the fiat system is a very, very different system, which does, you know, favor powerful people at the top, you know, who are kind of closer to the money printers. Whereas Bitcoin really, really is not related to that at all. It was, I think, you know, if I understand it correctly, it was created as a way to be kind of an instrument that people could use that had specific rules that were applied to it that were unchangeable, that would just kind of create like a structure for sound money. And yeah, so it's a tool. It's a tool of exchange, and it could be a tool for savings as well. But I don't really think that I don't see it as being like this, just this finite pie. Even though there's 21 million Bitcoin, and that's all that there will be. Like that's a different thing than being this finite pie kind of concept. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And one thing that I'd like to add is that sometimes it can be a little bit confusing for people when they think about Bitcoin and, like if the price goes up a bunch, then the earlier like holders that must like benefit them, so like they're promoting it or something, right? So what's different about Bitcoin is that there was no such thing as like a what's called like a pre-mine. So commonly with other, tokens, like Ethereum or Ether, the people that create it basically get a have a bunch already. And then the public can either, mine it or receive airdrop, it gets airdropped to them or something like that. So it's kind of similar, with to fiat currencies, and you'll hear about this referred to as like Cantillon effects, where basically, the insiders, the creators of the project, basically, if it does well, then they do really well because they were able to acquire a lot of, whatever the token is at like virtually no cost. Whereas the other people, the other kind of bag holders, acquired it at a substantial cost. And if the common like the reason we think about this negatively is because often what happens is that the insiders who create the token get a bunch in the pre-mine. There's a pump. The insiders sell at the top. Everybody gets wrecked, right? The this is like commonly referred to as like the shitcoin cycle. So but Bitcoin is different from that. And so that's another kind of more like that's another way to look at it, basically.
Yeah, and just one other thing is we did just release a research paper on this. Research paper makes it sound a little bit intimidating. It's like a primer, like a beginner's guide to Bitcoin. But there's some great research in it, and we do talk about this exact thing, which is why does the Bitcoin price quote unquote change, and how should we think about that? Like if we're calling it as something that you can save, and what doesn't it matter that it in dollar terms? And you have to kind of shift your thinking a bit because it you kind of have to accept this idea that okay, it's about purchasing power. It's not so much price, because if it's price, then what you're saying is it's like a dollar-centric statement. Okay, the dollar is the center of everything. That's the real measure of everything. And then how much is Bitcoin worth? If you use that worldview, that's fine, but then you have to also say, well, wait, but then how many dollars are there in the world? Well, nobody can actually tell you. There's nobody that can tell you how many dollars there are in the world. In fact, for example, banks in other countries are allowed to lend people dollars, or allowed to hold dollar liabilities, and there's no actual dollars there. Like, it's not even clear if they even have any dollars in reserve. They don't. They're beyond the reach of U.S. regulators, and so there's like all these dollars floating around, quote unquote, claims on dollars, and then you have, well, I mean, what happened in 2020 with the COVID checks, Kate? I don't know if you had this in Canada, but like
Oh,
billions,
yeah.
maybe hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars are totally unaccounted for. It's not even that they're stolen. They're just nobody knows where they are, who has them. So nobody knows how many dollars there are in the system, but we do know that they keep adding them, right? Because like there's constant bailouts, there's constant quantitative easing, and then they try to tighten, and then there's a disaster, and then there's a bank run. And so it's like they're running around, pulling these levers and pulleys and chains, trying desperately to keep this thing from falling apart. And they're adding dollars into the system. So okay, we all use dollars in the US. we're familiar with them. When the purchasing power of dollars changes, we call it inflation. And, you know, we have all these like terms for it, but really what's happening, the way Bitcoiners think about purchasing power, is Bitcoin is stable. You know exactly how many Bitcoin there are. In fact, it's trivial for anybody with a computer to audit the Bitcoin supply with a command at the command line. Go do that anytime you want, and you can see exactly how many Bitcoins there are, period. And nobody can change that. Okay, so it's a completely stable, predictable supply and system. Okay, so then when you say that it takes more dollars today than last year to buy a Bitcoin, what's really happening? Is Bitcoin appreciating in value, or is it that dollars are depreciating in Bitcoin terms? So Bitcoiners think about it that way. They think, well, it's the same Bitcoin. You know exactly how much Bitcoin you're getting. But now, like, monetary policy is loose and they're printing money. So now more dollars are chasing that same Bitcoin. So, of course, yes, the price in dollars is going to rise. If they tighten monetary policy now, okay, there's fewer dollars chasing that same Bitcoin. So the price in dollars is going to fall. But Bitcoin's Bitcoin. It's completely stable. And like I said, like, most people don't understand that. I get that. You know, it's a little bit fanciful. But I think over time, like, the math is sound there and the logic is sound. And I think more people kind of come to that realization independently.
Yeah, it's like a paradigm shift, right? Like, it's like you're not, you're thinking about two different things and two different systems. So I think that's kind of another way of looking at it. And so I think it requires, you know, going down the kind of rabbit hole of Bitcoin and trying to understand, you know, how different people see it, and, you know, and like, what are the different explanations for Bitcoin? Like, I'm reading this great book now by Jeff Booth. I don't know if you guys have read it. I forget what it's called, his newest
book. Layered Money.
You know, he talks about, yeah. And so that's a totally different way of looking at the world, right? Where it's like, you know, we live in this inflationary environment, but like, let's say, if Bitcoin does become ascendant, and not to mean that, you know, maybe other currencies or even fiat currencies won't exist, well, you know, Bitcoin is deflationary. So it's a different kind of thing, right? And so that requires you to like not necessarily compare them. And I think it's true what you said there, Dave. If you're always kind of chasing the tail of the ever-changing value of the dollar relative to Bitcoin, then you're comparing these two things, and it makes sense, because like, you want to understand, you know, how much Bitcoin do you have? Well, you want to know, well, how many dollars worth of Bitcoin do I have, right? But it's I guess it requires going down some rabbit holes to kind of explore for yourself, because there's not really like a simple explanation for it. It just requires some time and some understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bam, if you wanted to add to any of this, just for everybody's context, Bam does some great work with Coinbits on our kind of social media side of things.
Yeah, hey guys. Lovely conversation. To me, how I think about money is that it used to be physical, and two parties, if they want to exchange money, they need to be at the same place at the same time. And they need to exchange this monetary unit, whether it's gold or copper or whatever. And then we figured out, like, okay, we need to do commerce in a much faster way and globally. So how can we expand that range? How can we scale that system? Is by using ledgers. And so money has become a ledger, I think. I'm not sure when exactly. I always get the dates wrong, but money is just a ledger, and the problem is that who controls the ledger? Who controls adding lines to the ledger? Who controls issuing the monetary units? And that's the problem with crypto. That's the problem with altcoins. I want to say shitcoins, but I'm going to be a little bit disrespectful for people here. So the developers who issue these tokens are the ones who control the ledger. They are the ones who are responsible for adding lines to the ledger and issuing the monetary units. And so they can censor the transactions. They don't just control the tokens. They control the mechanism by which the token is generated. Okay, when we see like Vitalik doesn't just control large sums of Ethereum. Okay, he controls the mechanism by which Ethereum can be printed. He can change the monetary policy. Okay, and all of these altcoins and projects and smart contracts and stuff, it's very easy to hard fork them. And you know, hard forking is like you're not gonna ask anyone, any participant in the network for if they want to agree with you or not. There's no vote. You just hard fork. You just create a new rules for adding lines to the ledger. And in proof of work in Bitcoin, you can't add lines unless you expend a huge amount of energy for others to just judge the block, the judge the transaction that you want to add. Okay, are they compatible with whatever rules we have or not? And if they're not, they're gonna punish you. But when it comes to proof of stake, it's like who adds lines to the ledger? If you have money, the balances, the addresses that have money, who control the monetary units, are the ones who are in control of adding new lines to the ledger. And that's so messed up. Okay, that's literally fiat 2.0. Okay, like you know, it's the same corrupt system, but with different governance. Okay, with a different group, with a different ruling class. Okay, so all of it is just it's a clown show. It's unethical. Bitcoin is the real thing. When we say like it's capped, there's a reason why it's capped at 21 million. It's because we as humans, we always work, we always produce. And as Kate just said, you know, we produce value, but the pie or the monetary units are fixed, are capped. So each token can increase in value as our productivity increases. And so the pie really is just going to expand and expand forever. But the tokens that represent the value in that pie will just grow in value instead of increasing in number. So that's just my view on money and Bitcoin and crypto and all of that. All of that stuff. Sorry if I bored you guys.
That was great.
Yeah, that was great. Not at all. Thank you, Bam. I guess so. You know, we're reaching, you know, the top of the hour here, and I kind of want to give a little bit of a summary for those in the audience. You know, we announced today that Kate Wand, great, just fantastic content creator, producer on all things Liberty and Bitcoin, has joined Coinbits as an ambassador. And, you know, we've had this really wide-ranging conversation about, you know, COVID, totalitarianism, freedom, both financial freedom and psychological freedom, how to prepare yourself for like upcoming threats, and also really like how to move on and like really steel yourself for the future. And I guess, Kate, if you wanted to leave us with some final thoughts on, you know, financial freedom and psychological freedom, feel free to. But I think after that, maybe Dave can give an overview about Coinbits and everybody can have a wonderful weekend.
Great. Thank you so much, Dave. Yeah, I'll leave you guys with a few last thoughts. So as I said, you know, Psychological freedom and financial freedom are two things that are really important to me in my life. And I think that they're tools that can actually help you to live the life that you want, no matter what the external circumstances are. So thank you guys for having me. I really enjoyed this. And to be brief, I'll leave you with two quotes. Okay, so one is going to be on financial freedom. And the other one, the final quote that I'll read for you, will be on psychological freedom. So the first comes from Hayek in his book, The Denationalization of Money, where he imagined that at some point in the future, it might be possible that government did not monopolize money. And so he wrote in chapter 4, The Persistent Abuse of the Government Prerogative. When one studies the history of money, one cannot help wondering why people should have put up for so long with governments exercising an exclusive power over 2,000 years that was regularly used to exploit and defraud them. This can be explained only by the myth that the government prerogative was necessary, becoming so firmly established that it did not occur even to the professional students of these matters ever to question it. But once the validity of the established doctrine is doubted, its foundation is rapidly seen to be fragile. So that's number one. Number two, this is on psychological freedom. And this is from Viktor Frankl, who was a psychiatrist who got captured and ended up in concentration camps. And while he was there, took the time to actually study his fellow humans and himself and try to understand how it was possible that under the most horrific of circumstances, some people managed to keep their humanity and some people did not. And so I'll read this to you from Man's Search for Meaning. In attempting this psychological presentation and a psychopathological explanation of the typical characteristics of a concentration camp inmate, I may give the impression that the human being is completely and unavoidably influenced by his surroundings. In this case, the surroundings being the unique structure of camp life, which forced the prisoner to conform his conduct to a certain set of patterns. But what about human liberty? Is there no spiritual freedom in regard to behavior and reaction to any given surroundings? Is that theory true, which would have us believe that man is no more than a product of many conditional and environmental factors, be they biological, psychological, or sociological? Is man but an accidental product of these? Most important, do the prisoner's reactions to the singular world of the concentration camp prove that man cannot escape the influences of his surroundings? Does man have no choice of action in the face of such circumstances? And then he goes on to say, they may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing. The last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And there you have it.
That's awesome. Cue Steely Dan, you can go your own way. That's great. No, I love that book. I love that book. It's one of my favorite books. I'm so happy to hear you quoting it. That's Man's Search for Meaning. It's so much bigger and better than anything, like any one quote or any one topic. It's really about how you can find meaning in your life. And I just finished a piece with David, actually, a written piece about Generation Z, the Zoomers, how they struggle to find meaning and how it's wreaking havoc on their lives and their futures, and how Bitcoin is that meaning that they could find. They could rebuild our ruined financial system with Bitcoin, and that would give them that meaning that they're looking for. Oh no, there's silence.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. I hope that Dave is okay over there, but just to pick up on that ball, I mean, I think that that is totally the point. And Zoomers do have a really tough time. Like, you guys have inherited this world that is just like gone to the dogs. And so Frankl, he talks about three ways to pursue meaning. And one of them is, you know, through job or deed. The second is through your loving relationship, your relationship with your significant other, with your family, with some of your close friends. But then the third one is that when you take everything else away, when you strip everything from a man, you know, is there no meaning that they can find in in their suffering, and can they find a greater purpose for their life, you know, despite all of the external circumstances? So that's a very good point on Bitcoin, because, you know, having this purpose for people to say, you know what, we can actually put our energy into the future. And Dave Booth talked about this, Jeff Booth talked about this in a recent podcast that I saw on What Bitcoin Did, where he just said, you know, I'm putting all of my energy into Bitcoin and into building that architecture there, because I think that that is the world of the future. And why do I still want to be putting my energy and my time into the world of the past? You know, so that could be very purposeful for people who are looking for a way to figure out the mess that they're in, but look for a path forward too with hope.
That was beautifully said. Beautifully said. Thank you, Kate. Appreciate you. Appreciate you becoming Coinbit's latest ambassador. Guys, there's a link on our website, coinbit.app/ambassador/Kate-Wand. That's where you can find her link. I'm sure she can share it around. And when you sign up there, you can get free sats in your account just for signing up to Coinbit's. Kate is an awesome Liberty influencer and content creator. We're so looking forward to working with her. By the way, sorry guys, I'm like on this crazy street in Miami Beach, and you're talking about the Shire. I also live sort of in a Shire-like environment at home, and I'm just totally reminded why I chose that and did not choose the city, as these like incredibly loud things go flying by me and break my concentration. Anyway, thank you all for being here. We are Coinbits. We are a Bitcoin-only financial services company. No matter what you're thinking, you need with Bitcoin, we can probably help out. Our bread and butter is our app that lets you do roundups, dollar cost averaging. We're releasing retirement accounts very soon, so that's going to be cool. So you can save for retirement with Bitcoin. So check us out at coinbits.app. And thanks all for coming. And we do this every week. So follow us on Twitter and you'll stay up to date. And please join us next Friday for another session. And thanks very much for coming by. Talk to you all later. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much.
See you guys.
Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. So what do you think of the conversation? Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at CoinbitsApp. And be sure to subscribe to be notified of our next episode release. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Bitcoin Roundup podcast.